200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. We have a fascinating guest tonight, but before we have her on, let me say hello, Maria. How are
hello.
You?
Very well, Michael. Thank you so much from the West Coast to the East Coast, and you with your weather.
Well, we're doing okay, and I gotta start, since it's Women's History Month, I have to start by giving a shout-out to my alma mater, the University of Maryland, where the Lady Terrapins have just won the Big Ten tournament. I know you're a basketball fan, Maria.
Yes.
They scored 104 points.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations,
oh, my
Michael.
Goodness. Yes, I'm very Yay. Proud to be a Terrapin today.
Yeah,
nice. The men didn't do so well. They got knocked out in the second round. But the women's basketball team is just amazing at Maryland. And speaking of amazing women, we have certainly with us tonight one of the most fascinating people. The more I learned about this woman, the more intrigued I was. We have with us Daryl McKissick, who's the chairwoman and chief executive officer of McKissick & McKissick, an architectural engineering and program and construction firm managing more than $15 billion in projects nationwide. During the past 25 years under her leadership, McKissick & McKissick has managed such landmark projects as the Museum of African American History and Culture, a must-see, in Washington, D.C., on the National Mall, the MGM National Harbor Casino, and where I've lost money, and the Navy Pier Centennial Project in Chicago, and she was also involved in the the architectural firm of record on the Martin Luther King Memorial here in the district, also a must-see.
And the George H.W. Bush Library.
And the George H.W. Bush. I'm sorry to be so partisan. I forgot that.
Yes, thank
God we have a Republican on the show. And the George H. Bush Library, W.H. Bush Library. So excited to have you with us today, Ms. McKissick. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm
especially
excited
as
about
a Washingtonian. We're so proud of you, you know. I know your family's originally from Tennessee, but we claim you here in Washington as one of our great women executives. So thanks so much for being here.
And a Howard University grad.
And a Howard University grad. One of my great honors has been to sit on the as one of the sponsors of the Thurgood Marshall Dinner that gives money to HBCUs here, and we have several of them in the Washington area. One of the greatest, of course, is Howard University. So thanks for being with us again today. Let's start it. Give us a little background. You have such a fascinating background. Your family goes so far back in architecture. Your great-great-great-grandfather? Is that right?
Yes, I'm fifth generation. And I just wanted to add, you know, I live in L.A. part-time. So I'm East Coast, West Coast as well. Oh. So I'm glad that
I'm in Los Angeles. Yes.
Is on the phone. Yes. I go back and forth. I've been doing that for about 15 years now.
And is that because of your business on the West Coast too? Since you've got offices throughout the country?
Yes, I have an office in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
That's a lot. Plus Baltimore, Chicago, Dallas, and Austin.
Yeah.
Correct. And Los Angeles and Baltimore, D.C. Nice. The DMB is what we call it now.
Yeah, right. We're a region. We want to be a state, but they've turned us into a region. So I guess we'll settle for that for right now. You know, I read in one of the articles that when you started, an article that was in Architecture Magazine, that when you started in this business, Ms. McKissick, you said that people made it clear to you, your bosses made it clear to you that you should stay in your lane. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, let's see. You asked me two questions, and one's about my family background, and then I'm going to go into the other. And I just wanted to say that, you know, when I started my business in D.C. 30 years ago, people kind of knew me in my industry, but of course I needed more than that in order to grow the business to where it is today. And I am just so appreciative that the people in Washington gave me a chance. And because they gave me a chance, I was able to transfer all of my experience to other cities across the nation. But I have to say, it would never have happened had I not had Washington, D.C. So the residents and the leaders in Washington are near and dear to my heart. And my family goes back five generations. My great-great-grandfather, he was a slave. He came here in 1790 and actually landed in what's Tennessee today. But back then, it was North Carolina. Right. And he was the slave of a large contractor who taught him construction. But he came here knowing how to build bricks. And he was able to pass that down as well. But being able to build, to make bricks, allowed him to buy his freedom eventually. But he taught his son to be a carpenter. And his son, who's my great-grandfather, became a master carpenter and passed the trade of construction and carpentry down to my grandfather. And my grandfather and his brother went to corresponding school to become architects. And they were the first licensed black architects throughout the Southeast. Their licenses were 117 and 118 in the state of Tennessee. And then they went on to get licensed throughout the Southeast. So they designed and built a lot of the historically black colleges and universities. And, of course, they did a lot of other projects, you know, mainly throughout the Southeast. But they were also a little international. They did work in Kuwait. They did work for Papa Doc down in Haiti. And they also did some work on some of the housing around the country, which put my grandfather on a board with President Roosevelt to advise him on housing nationwide. But that business was passed to my father, and he, of course, built it even further and had three girls. And he said, "What on earth am I going to do with you all?" But when we were six, I'm a twin, and my 91-year-old mother is here visiting me right now. But, of course, on Saturdays, she wanted to get us out of the house. And my father would take us down to the office and prop us up on the drawing table, and we would draw. And by the time we were 12 and 13, he was actually using our detailing on his real projects. And so, you know, we just sort of went into that business. I feel like it's part of my blood. You know, people ask me, "Have you ever thought about doing anything else?" Well, you know, I used to tease him a lot, my sister and I, say, "Okay, if we can't get those shoes, we might want to be doctors one day." but we never really did that. So, coming, you know, he said, "You can go to school anywhere in the world, but I'm only paying for you to go to Howard University."
Wow. So, I like this guy already. Where,
mm-hmm. He went to school. And so he sat down with the dean of architecture and engineering and worked out our curriculum to get a degree in both in 6 years. And after working, you know, trying to get through 24 hours a semester, maintaining a 3.8 average after 2 years, I just said, I just want to finish in engineering. I felt like I was an implementer and not necessarily the creative one to design a building, but I could definitely get it built. And that sort of pushed me into the construction world. So just think about almost 40 years ago, a young Black girl going into the construction industry. And, you know, of course, I had the choice of coming home to Nashville and working for the family. And, you know, that was living in kind of a bubble because my grandfather on the other side was the dean of Fisk for 30 years. He graduated from Harvard with a PhD in 1929.
Oh, my
gosh. So we kind of lived, yes. And you know, of the whole reading side, my grandmother was a professor, English professor. So we sort of lived in a bubble in Nashville. I do remember at around 7 or 8, I was visiting my godfather, and he was a big civil rights lawyer in Tennessee, and it was his son's birthday. He was a friend of my sister and I. And all of a sudden, everybody said, come outside, and there was a huge cross burning in his front yard. Hmm. And, you know, that was probably one of the most fearful times of my life because I just couldn't imagine, like, what is going on and why are people burning a huge cross in this yard? And, you know, that is when our parents really start talking to us about racism in America. And so, you know, you grow up with knowing that this exists. It's always a question when you walk in the room. You know, I was asked the other day, you know, how did I feel about it? And of course, there's some pain that goes with that when you're first going through it. But after a while, I always feel like it made me stronger because I always felt like I had to be better than my white counterparts in the room. I had to be smarter. I had to know more. And so when I started in the construction industry, I would be the first one there in the morning, and I would be the last one to leave at night. And I would ask my boss before he left, is there anything that you need for me to do today? Anything else? And I learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot. I was way ahead. And I was bringing a lot of information home at night, studying it at night. And yes, I was just told to just do my job. And it wasn't necessarily a racial or a gender, I think, request. I just think that the way work was done back there. But were there racial microaggressions that were going on? Yes. I mean, my boss had a Confederate flag the size of his entire wall behind his desk. I would sit there with him every day.
Did he have that before he hired you? Was that there?
Yes, that was just him.
Okay.
That was who people were allowed to be who they, especially white men, they were allowed to be who they were at all.
What do you
times.
Think a man like that was able to break through maybe some of his inherent racism and hire you?
He didn't hire me.
Oh, he didn't hire
me. I worked for a company. The company hired me, and they placed you where they wanted you to go. So I was with him for about 2.5 years, and then I moved on. I mean, it's a big company, so, you know, I moved around quite a bit, but I was with him for 2 years. If anything, I feel like I gave him a little sensitivity about Black people. And a lot of times when you are educated, and you can talk and you can follow out all their everything. You can follow through on direction. I sort of feel like you get pulled out of the category of being Black. There's a separation. He used to have a separation between me and the laborers. And he'd say, oh, they're lazy. And he would roll their eyes at them because they took naps. during lunch, but they were in school at night, and that was their time to take a respite during the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, Ms. McKissick, I think that's one of the really terrible things about segregation is that, I come from a family where my mother's family were immigrants, and they believed every stereotype about everybody. And they lived in a segregated neighborhood. They lived in their tiny little bubble, as you called it in Tennessee, but in their tiny little bubble. And they never really got to see the things that you're talking about. They never got to see Black people, for example, that succeeded. They only got to see other people that were just like them. So it must have been really hard for you at the beginning, because I was a construction laborer. I was the guy that dug ditches and carried cement and did all the nasty jobs on construction projects. But I got to tell you, this is before I went to college. I got to tell you, I never saw a woman on a construction site when I started. Never saw a woman in the office. Yeah. Never saw a woman directing anything. And certainly never saw a Black woman here in Washington. So it must have been really something for you to break through those barriers. And from all reports, everything that I've read about you, you've not only done it, but you've done it with a lot of grace and with an incredible amount of confidence. Can I ask you, how did it feel to work on the African-American Museum of History and Culture? That must have been exciting.
Yes, it was an honor. And every day I learned something new. And, I guess the important thing that I really took away from that project was that there are a lot of different points of view on the National Mall, but none of those point of views really had the point of view through the lens of African Americans, just like we don't have a point of view through the eyes of women. Okay. And I have a problem with that. I wish we could get our women's museum up there. So that was great. And, you learn about the struggle, you learn about the passage to America and all the struggling that African Americans had to go through, Jim Crow laws, lynchings, and just a lot of really bad atrocities and challenges. But when you come upstairs and you start seeing the light of outdoors, what comes to light are all of the contributions that, in spite of all of this negativity, all of the contributions that Black people have made to this country and the world. And that was just exhilarating for me. I just can't stop going to the museum because there's always cool something museum. New there. And for us to, be the oldest African-American architectural firm in the country, for my great-great-grandfather to start as a slave, and to have continuously worked in the construction industry every generation, to be able to land a project like that, it is just very rewarding. We worked on the Martin Luther King Memorial, and that too was a very special project. Both of these projects, I feel, sort of help America sort of shift America's values and paradigm of thought, because both of those projects bring just a different perspective that we haven't seen on the National Mall. And so that project, was very big, and we were excited. I mean, it was big in the sense that for us, it gave us national visibility and a little bit of visibility globally. But then the African American Museum just brought us to a whole nother stage of visibility. Not that we were really looking for that. For me, the purpose for me in most of these kinds of projects and most projects that we do is to enhance people's lives. So I just want to see a change when people see our work, or if it's a school kid in one of our schools, that they're living an enhanced life, or they're getting a new look at things. And so the African American Museum, I just think every time you go in there, and if you go in there with the intent of an open mind, you're going to grow and you're going to change. It's sort of like going to Rome. Every time I go to Rome, I stumble up on something that makes me think different about the Italian culture. And I just feel the same way about the African American Museum.
And the senator took me there when I visited the District of Columbia a couple years ago, and I could have spent all day. It not just the grandeur of it, but as you said, the history of it and how it touches you as an American. And I felt the same with the Holocaust Museum in the District of Columbia. It was, it's humbling. It's humbling. And then the beauty of it, of what you did, is also just amazingly gorgeous. But I would like to let you share with our listeners a story about your persistence and your ambition and your tenacity about the head of procurement for the Treasury Department. Yeah. If you could tell our listeners about your persistence in that regard.
And excuse me, just one second before you answer that question, Ms. McKissick, let me remind people, you may not know this, but many of the great buildings in Washington, D.C. that we revere, like the White House and the Capitol, were built with slave labor. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to throw that in.
Yes, they were. And we think that one of our ancestors worked on the Capitol.
Wow.
Yes. But, I believe, I've had to stare down the barrel of a lot of no's and eventually make them a yes in order to have just a little bit of success in my career. But under President Clinton, I had the opportunity to go to a reception, and I met Secretary Rubin. And it was in the Treasury building in his cash room. And I just said, it would just be so nice if a firm like mine could work for the U.S. Treasury. And he says, well, let me introduce you to the head of procurement. So I met the head of procurement. His name was Wes Holly, and I said, okay, Wes, is there anything I can do for you? He said, nope, not today. But every 2 weeks I would go there, and during those days, you didn't have to have security. This was pre-September 11th, and you could just walk in as long as you had an ID, and I think as long as you paid your taxes. Yes, you had to have paid your taxes. You could get into the Treasury building. Anyway. And so every Friday I would go in and ask for some work, and he would say no. So finally, after 2 years.
2 years.
2 years. I
That's
went in
a
every
long
two
time.
Weeks. What's that, 104 times? At least 100 times. Every 50-something times, 60 times I went in there, and finally he said, oh, my God, just give her something. I am tired of seeing her every 2 weeks. So I'm like, really? And he said, yes. So they found a job, and it was to do some design reviews for an electrical distribution system that they were working on. And I was so happy. So we signed a little contract, and that evening, I went out to dinner, and I got home around 10:30 at night, and the phone rang, and this guy said, can I speak to Mr. McKissick? And I said, well, he's dead. And I started laughing on the phone because, of course, I had a couple of glasses of wine at dinner to celebrate my little contract. And so he says, well, lady, this is Secret Service. I said, oh, yeah, right. Who is this jokester on the phone? The Secret Service doesn't have a reason to call me. And I'm laughing on the phone. And he says, well, lady, the Treasury building is on fire. And I said, look, I just left downtown. I'm 10 minutes away from downtown, and I just didn't see any smoke. So who is this? And he said, well, why don't you turn on your television? So I turned on the television, and there was the Treasury building going up in smoke. And I said, oh, my goodness, this really is the Secret Service. How can I serve my country? Because I was getting a little nervous at that point for playing with them. And he says, well, we're looking for Daryl McKissick, and we need him to get down here right away. I said, well, wait a minute. I'm Daryl McKissick. So I said, I will be down there. And so I went down there, and the D.C. Fire Department was walking out of the building, and the procurement lead was out there and on the hood of my car. With a PC, we started working out a task order for me to start working on this building. So the building was 20% fire and water damaged, and then the other 80% was smoke damaged. And he wanted to get back in the 80% in 3 days, and I said I could do it.
Wow.
And then, of course, we did it, and then we started working on the other 20%, and then we realized the building wasn't operating efficiently and that it needed to be totally upgraded, and we had to do a presentation to Secretary Rubin. But let me just back up one moment and go back to how he got to me in the first place. So most of Treasury's procurement at that time was done by GSA, and the GSA was putting a new roof on Treasury, and the roofer's blowtorch started the fire. So the secretary was so angry, he said, I don't want GSA to touch my building. Is there anybody that has a direct contract with Treasury with construction? And I was the only person who had it.
Wow.
So that is how they got me in the first place. And, so we ended up with a $200 million restoration of Treasury.
Wow.
Which actually, yes, kind of grew because, you know, I went from one secretary to the next. But my other little story to that is that probably about 3 weeks before the Treasury fire, my in-house accountant called me in and she said, Daryl, I think you should sit down for this. So I said, okay, fine. So I sat down and she said, Daryl, I think we might be insolvent. And I looked at her kind of strangely and I said, you know, I don't know what that means, but it doesn't sound good. And I'm not that. And I just walked on out.
Just shows that persistence pays off. Let me ask you, I read this in an article that you and I had a similar feeling about D.C. public schools. D.C. public schools happen to be polling places. And when I went over to, I'll never forget this, an elementary school in Southeast, I couldn't believe, the building was unoccupied until I went over there to do some campaigning. And I saw kids going in and out of it, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, how could you let your children go into this horrible, dilapidated building? And I read somewhere where you had a similar experience going in when you went to speak at a high school in D.C. and went into the girls' room and saw how dilapidated it was. Now I understand your company has a division that works with K-12 management of buildings. And what are you doing to change that environment? Because I agree with you. It was just, when I saw the school, I couldn't believe it. It was Knoll Elementary School. I'll never forget it, in Southeast. So what are you doing to make a better environment in these schools for kids?
Well, actually, I would say it is the whole D.C. community that is making our schools better. For the last probably 15 years, we have supported bond money to really revamp our facilities in our schools. And we have some of the most well-designed schools that are flexible, great for teaching. They're sustainable, and we've got kids in a warm, safe, clean environment. And McKissick started. We were selected as the project managers when DC, I guess it was the first $3 billion that we received to work on the schools. And the plan was to touch every school as soon as possible, but then do complete renovations and build new schools as soon as possible, but great new schools that brought great architecture and revitalized the communities that they were in. And we've been able to see this across the city. And it's just been fantastic. But I'll never forget the day that I was walked into this bathroom, and it was probably about 20 years ago. And it changed the mission of my company, because prior to that, our mission, I sort of borrowed from my ancestors. I'm like, okay, we're going to be trustworthy partners with our clients, and we're going to always over-deliver and, you know, underestimate what we'll do, but always over-deliver and make sure we have good client satisfaction. But when I walked in that bathroom and I saw the dim lights, the mirrors that were just in such bad condition, you could barely see yourself. You know, a lot of the toilets off of the walls, many of the sinks gone. There was only two working sinks with just a dribble of water. I just said, how can we expect our girls to grow up to be these wonderful women that we want them to be when we're half them going to a bathroom that looks worse than the prisons that were being built back then? Even the prisons that weren't being built, it looked like a prison. And they had that whole saying called yo girls back then. And I'm like, and that's exactly the environment that we have them in to produce yo girls and not true women. And so that's when I said our mission at McKissick had to go past bricks and mortar, and it had to be about enhancing people's lives. And we want to work on projects that really make a difference in how people live. And we've expanded that to even say that in our company, we live in what's called the circular economy of care, which means we want the whole person to come to work every day, someone who's fulfilled and they feel good about who they are. And how do we help facilitate that? So it's an individual thing. But then if you're healthy and you come to work, then you can have healthy interaction with your teammates, which builds healthy teams. And then you can have healthy departments, which makes a healthy company. We spread that to our projects, which really helps us with our clients to enhance their interaction with us. And that even goes to the community. So I feel like that is really our role at McKissick, is to use the AEC industry to enhance people's lives.
And it's funny.
And I got to tell you, all three of my children went to DC Public Schools, and all three of those schools were renovated, and they're just amazing. They're amazing places now. They really, there was a transformation of many of the schools in the District of Columbia, and you should be very proud of your input into that process. Maria, do you have a question?
Thank you. I do. But also the subliminal message that is being gathered by, if I'm worthy, then why am I in unworthy circumstances? That how that can play, that loop can play in. And so for you to notice that, but a small thing such as the restroom, let alone a classroom. But you mentioned AEC, and I just want to say for our listeners, that's architecture, engineering, and construction. And to that end, you created something called a 7-step plan to confront racism in your industry. Would you mind sharing with our listeners what's the genesis behind why you did that, and then what the 7 steps are, please?
Yes. So the genesis behind that is that, first of all, I feel like the construction industry, what we do in each one of our projects is we sit down and we listen to all of the points of views. So we're kind of managing all the stakeholders that are at that table, right? Mm-hmm. We're looking at real facts and how to bring a project together and also meet the expectations of all the people sitting around that table. And that's kind of the situation we're in. We've got all of these people in America that come from different backgrounds, and they look different. But we all kind of want the same thing, but we might have a different perspective on it. So how do we bring all of that together, look at the true facts of what's out there, and come up with the optimal solutions that meets everybody's, not, you know, everybody's got a give and take, but meet expectations the best way you can. You know, we spend trillions of dollars a year in the construction industry, and we employ like 13 million people. That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So if anybody can transform this situation, it's just, I feel like our industry can do that. The first part of my plan is, number one, admit that we have a problem. Admit that there is racism, because it's so ingrained. It started with ideology, which became principles. Those principles went into systems, which are policy decisions and systems. And then the fruit of that is what you see on a daily basis. And they turn into microaggressions that people just don't even know that they even have racial tendencies. And by the way, that goes both sides. I think everybody can have microaggressions or biases about the other side, because they just don't know. And I think the best thing that happened to us in 2020 is that we're removing the scales from people's eyes, that all the challenges, the pandemic, all the pain, the suffering, the even the sandstorm, all the weather stuff that we had going on, and then, you know, the death of George Floyd, I believe all of those things made us remove the scales from our eyes, all the masking that we've had in America and individually, to say, okay, where do I really stand? Because there is no room for bystanders anymore. It's like you have to be somewhere, standing somewhere. Anyway, so I feel like the racism, you know, really comes from this long list of ingrained thought process. So we have to start there. We have to say, yes, racism exists. It's not that we can't find black firms or women firms. It's not that there are black people out here that can't do math and sciences. But what are we really doing to pull together, you know, make it so that these people can come to the forefront so we can see them? Because oftentimes they're just not even looked for. So number one is that racism does exist. The next one is looking at policies that may not have necessarily started out as a racism, but they end up being kind of racist policies that holds one group back, are sexist policies. And, you know, the construction industry is definitely a male-dominated industry. I would say I've been discriminated against more for being a woman than being black in the construction industry. So then the other part of the plan is, you know, promoting minorities and women, and even putting them in the boardroom. I mean, just to have, when I look at some of the top companies, Fortune 500 companies that I work for, there is a black person that's sitting on their board. There is a woman sitting on those boards. And so I think that really makes a difference. One of the biggest issues between, I would say, black black growth and white growth is the economic wealth gap that we have. And economically, the black people have been held back for many, many, many years. And it's time to try to even that playing field. And a good way to do that is to hire minority firms as primed, black firms and women-owned firms as primed on projects. Because, you know, one thing for sure is we're hiring black people. I mean, we hire everybody. But when people come in our company, they're not worried about racism or sexism because the CEO is black and a female. So that usually is not an issue on our table. But, you know, we're able to, I think, push the career growth of those of minorities and women.
Well, and as a resident of California, you may know that in 2018, women on boards legislation was signed, the first ever in the country, requiring publicly held corporations to have at least one woman on the board by the end of 2019,
yes.
And then one or two more are supposed to be by the end of this year, 2021. But we had to legislate that to make it happen, which I think is ridiculous,
yeah.
Since we're half of the population. And then to have one, but it was a beginning.
Yeah.
And the more women, the more women you get and minorities you get in these positions, the more you'll get in the future. When I was in graduate school, I did my senior paper on occupational segregation. And this was in the 1970s. There were 158 professions listed by the Bureau of Statistics, and 75% of all women were found in four of them. They were either secretaries or teachers or nurses or domestic help. Now they're found in all 158. So the more women and minorities you get into these positions, the more you'll have in the future. So do you have any sense? I know that construction and architecture was in your bloodstream, but do you have any suggestions on how we get more women and more minorities interested in STEM?
Yes, well, it starts, I believe, you know, in middle school and high school. And ACE Mentoring, which is a great organization, really sort of influences young students to go into STEM. And so the more organizations like Living Classrooms, we have that in D.C. and Baltimore with James Bond. It started in Baltimore, but they really go to, you know, into the community, and they're really getting these kids excited about STEM programs through all these different avenues, and it's really great. And I think that's where it starts. I mean, we have to start with what did George Bush have? Didn't he have 1,000 points of light?
Yes.
And he started.
Yeah.
I thought that was was that kids? I'm trying to remember.
That was Hope for All of Us, I think.
Hope
for America.
Then who was the president that started in I thought elementary school, like Head Start?
I'm not
those
sure,
kind of programs.
I'm sure it was a Democrat.
Okay.
Let's get the politics.
Okay, see, I'm bipartisan. I do museums for presidents like Obama and George Bush.
Yes, I know. I love that, too, about your resume.
Makes you the perfect question, Tony. And we're so proud of that.
And minority and women-owned companies that you do business with. We're talking about, you know, lending a hand up or down, whatever you want to say, or bringing someone up or down. Because I think that's important, too, and to the senator's point that diversity, equity, and inclusion is a win-win-win for all of us. And the richer the conversation comes from people coming from different walks of life and different life experiences. Because to me, the better the information, the better the decision, the better the execution, the better the project, the better the experience.
Yes, you definitely hit something there because, you know, at McKissick, we feel like, no, we don't embrace diversity. We celebrate it because the different perspectives gives us a better solution. And McKinsey did a study on that, and they've proven it helps your bottom line. But I had the great opportunity to visit the Apple headquarters out in Cupertino, California. Have you been there?
I have not. You're to there. The campus.
Okay. Out in California. But I was there during lunchtime, and when they opened up the doors and people were running through, going to lunch and everything, I was shocked. Because they had everybody there, every ethnic group you could imagine, every gender you could, not everyone, but a lot of genders and age group from young to very mature. And that is why they're doing so great in the FANG group, because they're listening to all corners of the world mm-hmm. to come up with the best product. And that's when I knew I was on the right track with, I want everybody in here. And I want to hear, you know, I started my company so that everybody would have a seat at the table, because that's not where I've worked in the past. I didn't have a seat at the table. I wasn't in the room. As a matter of fact, I was probably the last one to hear a decision. So my company is completely different. Everybody has a voice. We want to hear what people have to say.
In this seven-step plan for your industry, are you asking other entities to sign on to this so that you are approaching it, the architecture, engineering, and construction industry with the same sort of purpose, the same sort of end game, if you will?
I am, and I am a member of a group that has the top CEOs in the architecture, engineering, construction industry as members. And I'm talking to them quietly. And I have to say, some of my counterparts are already out there doing things. And I'm very proud of, you know, where they are and what they're trying to do. Of course, there's a lot to do. But I think we're going to have some really good partners with this 7-point plan.
Good. Thank you for that.
Let me lead the charge. Let me ask you, Daryl. What is the pandemic doing to your business? Is America going to look different after we get through all this? We now see a little light at the end of the tunnel, but what's happening in construction through all this?
Right. Well, you know, construction was deemed essential, so it really did not stop. It may have slowed down in certain areas due to maybe breakouts and sort of reworking how all of these people would work in the same space. But it's continued to go, and we've had some clients that have accelerated work because they took advantage of the fact that people were not in buildings, people were not on the street, and so they just wanted to accelerate their work. Going forward, I think we're kind of still in a holding pattern. Of course, there's a lot of innovative things going on about what the new normal is going to look like. And I think we're all going to change how we do things going forward. Yeah. It's just never going to be the same. So I think we're kind of looking at some of the new technology. You know, of course, there's going to be a lot of touchless entryways, and you know, most things will go to touchless over time. And then I think the air volume control, of course, there's going to be a lot of turnover of air within a space so that it's always being cleansed. And I think those are just some of the simple ones that you can just pull off, you know, really quickly, but there's going to be a lot more that's coming. And I think it's a great time for us to, you know, to move to another level of greatness. I think that's exactly where we're going to go.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's great opportunity here, and I hope that we all find ways to take advantage of it. We have a question that's been Skyped into us from a lady in Pennsylvania who wants to know, what buildings do you wish you had worked on, and what projects do you hope to get in the future?
Oh, my gosh. Which ones did I wish? Well, right now I have one that I know I would love to work on, and that's the Washington football team.
Yes,
I'm a big football fan, and I would love to work on that.
You're the same company with us.
And I wish I had worked, Ms. Sanchez, I wish I had worked on SoFi Stadium and Allegiant out in Las Vegas.
Yes. Both great.
And the SoFi Stadium would have been nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted our listeners to know that SoFi Stadium is the Los Angeles stadium for the Rams and the Chargers. And I can hardly wait to go there, because with COVID, we haven't really been able to, except for, I guess, first responders have been able to. But I'm a huge LA Rams fan, too, so that helps.
Well, and I've been a Washington football fan since I was a little boy, and I loved RFK. And I hated FedEx Field. I thought, you know, not that I've been there a lot, but I just didn't like FedEx Field, and I just loved RFK. So if they build a new stadium, I hope they do a better job than they did with FedEx. We're running out of time here, Ms. McKissick, so let us give you the opportunity. Is there anything that you want to say that you haven't had a chance to say before we sign off?
Well, it's just been great to talk to you both. You know, I love the East Coast, West Coast, and working in both places. I feel like I have kind of a unique perspective of, you know, our industry from both places. And, you know, there is a discrimination out there, and I'm glad that it's coming to light. I do feel that the more we work towards talking about it and, you know, getting to the root of the bias, that we can probably get over it at some point. I mean, I'm just hoping. I don't think I'm going to see it in my generation. I don't know if my daughter is going to see it. I have a 17-year-old. When I see what goes on sometimes at school, even though it's nothing with the school, but it's just people that the school has no control over. She's had terrible epithets written on, you know, virtually not on her screen, but just comes across the screen for everybody. And I just don't, you know, it's just sad, because those are younger kids that are doing that. So I don't know where the end is. But I think it starts with everybody individually. And if you have these bias against a group of people, why don't you just befriend one? Have dinner or lunch with one. If dinner's too much, start with a snack, some Fritos together.
It's a great idea.
And then have a drink together and just be open. I mean, I just talk to Black friends who have, you know, friends of other races, and they've sat down and they said, just come on and just tell me, what's your true fear about Black people? Or what is it that, you know, you really think? And it's shocking to hear what they say.
Right.
But you sit there and you just, they're being honest. They're your friends. You've loved them for a long time. So let's, you know, have an honest discussion about it and see how we can move the needle forward. It's not going to move forward by having all these conversations, big corporations talking about, we got to do something. Somebody has to sit down and really do something. And what my generation has seen is a lot of talk and no action. I mean, we have, you know, the George Floyd moment, but how many Black men have been killed since then? Mm-hmm. So it just keeps going on and on. Yes. You know, it was great that a lot of white kids and a lot of other groups of people joined in with Black people and protested in the streets. Yes. And that's fantastic. But still, we have to see really a lot more change. And it has to be action. I've had a lot of companies call and say, well, we want to know about your company and we want to work with a, you know, a black firm. But yet it's been a lot of presentations. Yeah. But did they kick us on a job yet?
No.
No.
Well, it sounds to me like
just the talk.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you're doing okay with $15 billion worth of contracts. And we thank you so much for being on the show. This is a great place to end it, I think. And you've just been an inspiration. I hope that all the women out there who have listened to the show are inspired by you, because you really have done an amazing, amazing job, Ms. McKissick, in creating the firm that you have and the legacy that you're leaving. And I hope your 17-year-old daughter understands that she's got to go into architecture now. She's got this apple choice after
six generations
of such an amazing family. So thank you so much for being with us. We hope you come back again sometime. You've just been an amazing guest. And we always leave people with a song at the end of the show dedicated to our guests. So here's one for Daryl McKissick from Alicia Keys. Thank you again, ma'am, for being on our show.
Thank you. And continued success.
Thank you so much, Ms. Sanchez.
Maria.
Maria.
Yes.
I hope to meet you in L.A. sometime.
Me too. Yeah. I would welcome that.
You have a standing invitation to share a bag of Fritos with me anytime you're in Washington, D.C., Ms. McKissick. Thank you so much.
Okay, great.